Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, top 10 legal battles suing the fans. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another episode in our series on the top 10 greatest music industry legal battles of all time. Or at least 10 of our favourites, which I think is a reasonable gauge of the best ever. Because why would we pick some that weren't the best ever?
We wouldn't.
So there you go. It is best 10 of all time. In fact, more this week because we're going to focus on two at once.
Yes. So the best two of 11. Is that what that makes? Does that maths add up?
Well, yeah, but the last one wasn't really a lawsuit, was it? So I think we're back up to 10. We've balanced it out.
Good.
Definitely, we're all covered. It's definitely top 10.
The maths is working.
I think it's got very confusing. Anyway, we're going to go back. God, you mind way back to the good old days when major record labels used to go around suing individual file sharers like that was ever going to be a good idea.
Yeah, so you mentioned we're going to focus on two lawsuits in this edition. Although, I mean, there were a lot that we could choose from. So basically, there was a period in the 2000s where the record industry in the UK and in Germany, but mainly in America,
yeah,
threatened legal action against an awful lot of individuals who had used file sharing networks to either share or access music, illegally distributed music. So lots of people were threatened with legal action, and there were other court cases about this as well. But there were two big lawsuits that grabbed a lot of headlines because they went to court.
And they went on for a long time.
Yeah, in most cases, they went to court again and again and again. These were long-run cases. So there were two particular record industry versus file sharing, well, we're calling them sue the fan cases. We'll talk more about later how the music industry doesn't like them being called that. But two sue the fan cases in particular, both of which happened, of course, in America. And those were the cases between the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA or RI double, no time to be.
Oh, let's not start that.
Dissing their terrible name again. The RIAA versus Jamie Thomas and Joel Tenenbaum.
So for this, we have to cast our minds back to the mid-2000s when the world of recorded music was a very different place to what it is today. The boom times of the 1990s had been brought to an abrupt end by Napster and started the period when the record industry, and in the main, the major labels, had attempted to turn their tumbling profits around by trying to make the internet go away.
Now, we have talked about this period on previous special editions of Setlist.
We have.
Not as part of this series, but when we were doing the 20 biggest stories that CMU covered in its first two decades in business. Several of those were dealing with the emergence of digital music and of the unlicensed digital music services and the music industry's various attempts to try and battle with online copyright infringement. And so we talked about the battle against Napster, which you mentioned,
yep,
the first file sharing platform to get headline-grabbing status, and so the lawsuits against Napster. And then, of course, there was a whole string of lawsuits, so we could have talked about the Grokster one and the Kazaa one and the LimeWire one, but it was the Pirate Bay that got its own special. And we talked about the music industry's love affair with digital rights management technology. Mm-hmm. So we had this period where they were going, right, all these internet things infringing our copyrights, we'll sue all the websites and all the technology makers out of business. That didn't work. I mean, they won in the main. I mean, as we discussed in the Napster special, initially there was some legal ambiguities. Was Napster even liable for copyright infringement? In some places around the world, particularly in some European jurisdictions, there was even a debate in the early cases about whether or not sharing music online was even copyright infringement. So there were a few legal questions in the early days. But in the main, particularly in the US, when the record companies sued Napster and then Grokster and then LimeWire, ultimately they won. And most of those services, obviously Pirate Bay is the big exception, but in most cases, as soon as those services have been found liable for copyright infringement in court, they go away, they disappear. A victory for the record industry. but not because, of course, as we also discussed on those special editions, as soon as one had been sued out of business, there was another ready to take its place.
Sometimes more than one.
And often more than one ready to take its place. We also, during this period, again, there was a special on this back in the archives, the music industry were like, okay, if we can't sue the file sharing services out of business, maybe we can use technology to fight technology. And we had the whole period where the record industry had its love affair with digital rights management technology, so that there was DRM on CDs to stop people ripping the tracks, and there was DRM on the legally available downloads from the early download stores, including iTunes, all of which meant that the fledgling legal digital music services were shit compared to the illegal services. So people carried on accessing music through the illegal services rather than the emerging legit services. So the record industry's attempts to sue the file sharing companies out of business had worked in that they sued them out of business, but it didn't stop any file sharing. Meanwhile, DRM was a disaster. And so what we're talking about today, in essence, I suppose, was the third strand of the record industry's attempt to get rid of this file-sharing problem.
Yes, they started suing individual music fans for illegally accessing music online, either uploading or downloading, or in many cases, both, because that's how file-sharing technology works. But I guess you can kind of see the logic of that. You can see the meeting where they decided that that was going to be the way forward. The idea would presumably be that kind of once people saw that the record labels could not only see who had been accessing music illegally, but were going after them and demanding money, then people would get scared and just not do it anymore.
Yeah, so it was a deterrent is the point.
Yes.
Because I suppose that was one of the challenges, wasn't it, for the record industry. Even once we'd had the test cases that concluded that, yes, sharing music through a file sharing network without license, that's copyright infringement, and the people who make the technology are liable for contributory or authorising copyright infringement. Even once we got the legalities sorted out, I think most people in the record industry recognise that by this point, across the world, certainly millions of people were sharing music in this way. And so although the law says, well, that's definitely copyright infringement, and then the next bit of law says, if people infringe copyright, sue them for damages, clearly you can't sue millions of people. I mean, if you showed up at court with millions of lawsuits, the judges wouldn't accept it.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, there's a cost to a lawsuit. I mean, beyond whatever it is you're actually paying to file the paperwork with the court, where there is a cost there, there's all the legal and admin costs associated with it. So suing millions of people wouldn't work and would cost a lot of money. But you're right. The hope, I mean, hindsight, it was a stupid hope. And I'm pretty sure at the time I was saying it was a stupid
yes.
hope. But you were giving them the benefit of the doubt. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. The hope was, as you say, right, let's find some people who have definitely been sharing music. And I think there was a tendency to skew towards the uploaders rather than the downloaders. Although, as you also alluded to, I mean, on a file sharing network, once you're in the network, you're kind of doing both.
Yeah, people were uploading possibly without even knowing.
Exactly. But we'll find some people who have uploaded music into a Napster, or actually by this point, Napster had gone. So a lot of these, Kazaa, I think, was the file sharing platform
yeah.
of the moment when these cases were being filed. We'll go and sue some people and we'll win because we're pretty certain now the copyright law is on our side. So we'll get these people, they'll go to court, they'll have to hand over a few £1,000 probably in damages or maybe more. But crucially, this will get news coverage. People will know about it. And people will be like, oh my God, they found those people, they're spying on us, they'll find me, I'll have to pay a few grand minimum damages, I don't want that, do you know what, I'm going to go and try out this thing called iTunes and stop stealing music, was the hope,
yes,
which as we've already said, was a stupid hope because it didn't work. If anything, it made more people aware of the fact that there was a way of accessing lots of music for free. And I think even though one of the big differences between online file sharing and old school tape-to-tape piracy that had happened 10, 20 years earlier, is that it is possible for a copyright owner to spy on what's happening on the internet. You can only ever identify somebody by their IP address.
Yeah.
And only the ISP, the internet service provider, knows who is using that IP address, which was one of the problems of these cases, because actually, in order to sue somebody for file sharing, you had to do two lawsuits.
Yes.
First of all, you'd sue the ISP to get the name and address of the person, and then you'd sue the actual person. But I suppose the key point was that although it was a little bit complicated to go through that process, rights owners could see and ultimately find people who were infringing their copyright in a way you never would have been able to with the tape-to-tape thing. which is why the record companies were hoping that this may become a deterrent. Oh my God, they found that person had to pay a few grand in damages, it could happen to me. But even once you had a few hundred, or in the US ultimately, a few thousand of these were lawsuits or warning letters going out, it still, for the average file sharer, felt incredibly removed in a, it will never happen to me. And so much so that it wasn't a deterrent. Here in the UK, the BPI did, I think, about 100 of these lawsuits, the two-stage lawsuits. It was front page news. It had no impact on file sharing rates. And the UK record industry very quickly were like, yeah, that's not going to work. We thought it might be a deterrent. We were wrong. It's not. We need to go and find some other way of doing it. But in the US, the RIAA, possibly because they'd found a slightly easier way of getting in touch with the suspected file sharers, they didn't give up at 100.
Yeah, so they had a system where they found the IP address of the person who they alleged had been infringing their copyrights, and then got the ISP to send the letter on to that person. And those letters would basically arrive and say, we know you've been stealing music, give us a few thousand dollars and we won't sue you.
That system of getting the ISPs to forward on the letters so that the copyright owner doesn't actually need to know the name and address of the accused file sharer, unless they don't settle and go to court. That did actually start being done here in the UK as well, eventually, and has been done in an assortment of other countries as well, because actually this is where you started talking about speculative letter sending, and there was the allegation that some copyright owners were just sending out all of these letters to people not really knowing that there was suspected file sharing, in the hope that people would just send in checks for a few hundred or a few thousand dollars. And there were allegations that certain legal firms or companies that specialise in sending these letters were just building a business, and it's almost like a protection racket, isn't it? Not accusing the RIAA of that, but they were an organisation to quickly latch on to, okay, this is a slightly simpler way of approaching these file sharers. We'll send out these letters, we'll demand an albeit nominal settlement, although if you haven't got much money, $500 is a lot of money, and we'll demand these settlement figures. But initially, for certain, I mean, whether or not it became a business later, possibly it did, and certainly with some of the other copyright owners who subsequently pursued that approach, it did almost become another revenue stream. But for definite initially, the idea was if we send out a whole load of these letters and then word gets around that these letters are going out, we will find you, we will demand damages, we will threaten legal action. That's a deterrent. It will stop file sharing. It wasn't a deterrent. It didn't stop file sharing. And there was literally thousands and thousands and thousands of these before the RIAA finally gave up. Although in most cases, people did pay the money.
Yes. And I mean, one issue with it is that obviously an IP address identifies an internet account rather than an internet user. And so quite often what's happening is these letters are turning up addressed to the account holder, which is possibly the parents of a teenager who had been file sharing. They're opening it up, bulking and paying up. Maybe, well, something probably happened. Maybe the teenager was grounded, but the teenager doesn't get the financial hit and the deterrent, and probably thinks, oh, I'm not going to get caught again.
It also threw up various debates around, well, hang on a second, are we holding the IP owner liable for somebody else's infringement on their account? What if they've got a Wi-Fi hub? And this was the early days of Wi-Fi, when people weren't necessarily quite so full on locking down their Wi-Fi, and lots of people had Wi-Fi without passwords. Are we saying that you are responsible for everybody using your Wi-Fi? All sorts of questions being posed there, which actually in many cases, in many countries, were never properly answered. Because as we say, a lot of people, when they got these letters, whether they were off the RIAA or all the other copyright owners around the world who subsequently started sending these letters, most people just settled. But the two people that we're focusing on today were important in this whole story because they didn't settle. In essence, they called the record industry's bluff, and then the record industry called their bluff over the bluff, and we actually had some litigation.
Yes, and in fact, both cases outlasted the campaign of letter sending because they went on for so long.
Yeah, long enough that even the RIAA had worked out that this was a rubbish way of dealing with online copyright infringement. We said that neither Jamie Thomas or Joel Tenenbaum would agree to the settlement proposed in the original letter that was sent out. Actually, one of them tried to do a deal.
Yes. So the first of those to receive a letter was Joel Tenenbaum in 2003, or as suggested, his parents received the letter as the payers of the internet bill. It demanded $3,500 for illegally downloading music. Tannenbaum was then a 20-year-old student and wrote back saying, I don't have $3,500, but I'll give you $500 instead just to make this go away. To which the RIAA said, no thanks.
$3,500 or nothing.
Yes. So 4 years later, in 2007, the lawsuit eventually arrived, which accused him specifically of downloading 31 files illegally through Kazaa. It was actually alleged at trial that he'd downloaded and shared many more files than that, but it was 31 that they specifically focused on.
Yes, I suppose in these lawsuits, you have to state specifically, you can't just say downloaded a lot of music, because as the record companies who are suing, so because this was led by the RIAA, actually it would be the major record companies who were listed as the plaintiffs on the case.
Yes, and generally there would be one label who was the lead label, so they'd pick their songs.
Well, exactly. You've got to show that whoever's suing does own the copyright in the tracks you're saying the copyright has been infringed on. So therefore, you have to specifically list some tracks. So yeah, it was very common in these cases for the labels to say, we suspect it was hundreds, possibly thousands of tracks that were illegally accessed or shared, but here's 30 specifically.
Meanwhile, in 2005, Jamie Thomas received her letter. She denied that she'd shared any files over the internet at all, and declined to pay the initial settlement.
And I suppose that's the key difference between these two cases, in that Tannenbaum was basically saying, yeah, I did do that, but I haven't got any money.
Yeah.
Whereas Jamie Thomas was actually saying, as we alluded to earlier, I may be the account holder on this account. Maybe you have seen some copyright infringement activity on this account, but I'm telling you, it wasn't me.
Yes, but she was sued the following year in 2006, accused of downloading and sharing 24 files through Kazaa. Although when it came to trial, they said it was more like it was over 1,700 they'd identified, but it was those 24 that made it to the actual lawsuit.
Now, in both of these cases, once the lawsuits had been filed, the record companies were pursuing good old statutory damages, which is something that we have talked about quite a bit on Setlist over the years. So this is a feature of American copyright law that says that if somebody infringes your copyright, whereas here in the UK, usually in a copyright infringement case, we have what we call actual damages. So if a record company was suing somebody for copyright infringement, they would either say, OK, you infringed our rights, we think you made X out of the infringement, although that wouldn't work for file sharing, because obviously when you shared music through a Kazaa-type platform with other people, you weren't making any money out of that. Mm. Everybody was just sharing for free. So you couldn't sue them for actual damages in terms of what they've made, because they haven't made anything. So instead, you'd sue for what you think you had lost. So you would say, OK, well, you uploaded that track. We think 2,000 people downloaded it. If we'd sold that track on iTunes, we would have got $1 a track, £1 a track, whatever. So therefore, we're £2,000 down and we want £2,000 or $2,000 or whatever. But with statutory damages, you'd have to do any of that tedious working out exactly how much money was lost as a result of the infringement. You simply say, OK, this track was infringed, and American copyright law, through this thing called statutory damages, allows you to claim, well, they start at $750 per track. So obviously, if you reckoned that $2,000 had been lost as a result of people nabbing this track for free, then $750 is no good. But they go all the way up to $150,000 per track.
It's quite a lot.
It is quite a margin. So first of all, there is the question of whether or not the infringement was willful or not.
Yeah.
So you have to prove that it was willful to get the higher figure. But yes, you can sue for anything up to, assuming it's willful infringement, $150,000 per work. That's per work. So remember, if they're naming 31 works in the litigation, it will be 31 times 150,000. So that's what the record companies were pushing for in both of these cases, which means you end up, if you go with the 150,000 per infringement figure, with substantial damages claims in both of these lawsuits against a student and a single mother.
Yeah, although I think obviously by fighting these cases, both were pretty confident that they could win it and beat the labels. Although once they got up in front of a jury, each of them lost very quickly. Tannenbaum actually admitted to sharing 30 of the files that the label said he did. And what happened with the other one? And
maybe it was something so embarrassing he didn't want to admit.
Well, their files are all lit. You can see what they are. Maybe you're right. Yeah, there were some Red Hot Chili Peppers in there.
Maybe that's what it was. You can understand that. That makes sense.
Although more than one. So maybe there's one really embarrassing one. But then he offered the hopeful defence that he didn't realise when he was doing it that it was illegal.
Yes, so as we said, from the start, pretty much, Tenenbaum admitted that he had been file-sharing music through his internet account, hence why he'd originally offered the $500 settlement. But his defence in court was, I'm just a non-specialist student. I don't understand copyright law. Everybody was file-sharing.
I assumed that this thing was available, so it must be legal.
I thought it was fine, which is different to the Jamie Thomas defence, because she stood by what we've originally said, which was, I don't know anything about files being downloaded illegally on my account.
Yes. So Tenenbaum, having admitted his guilt, then the jury was told by the judge they basically just needed to decide what damages he should pay. So somewhere between $22,500 and $4.5 million.
Yeah, because of those stupidly, the big wide range that statutory damages allow, all the way up to $150,000. Once you start multiplying that by 30, 31, it gets that the margin is huge. So, yeah, the judge was saying to the jury, we don't need to decide whether or not there was copyright infringement here because this guy's admitted he file-shared these tracks. Case law tells us that that's copyright infringement, so we know he's liable for infringement, but what is he liable for? There's a massive margin to pick from. Hey, jury, pick a number.
In the end, they went for $675,000. I mean, that's a way off $4.5 million. Still a lot of money, especially if you don't have any.
Yeah, for a guy who I think quite honestly had said he can't afford $3,500. It would take him a long time to find $3,500, but he was going to try his best to find $500. The thought of him having to go out and try and find $675,000, bearing in mind this was before the era where crowdfunding had really taken off. I sort of feel had these cases happened now, that person would have gone onto a GoFundMe type account and said, hey, file sharers of the world, I'm taking on the evil record industry machine. I lost. Will you help me find this $675,000? But it's kind of before that era. And so the chances of him being able to find that were pretty slim.
Also, we should probably note that because this was an interesting legal case where it was a kind of a grey area still, people weren't really sure what the precedent was. Both of them were represented pro bono, not initially for Jamie Thomas, but from the start for Joel Tenenbaum. They were not having to pay for their legal representation. So that obviously meant that they could fight these cases and take them as far as they did.
Yes, without having to worry about paying their own legal fees, even if they won, I guess,
yeah.
Ultimately. And in the case of Tenenbaum, it was a Harvard Law School professor called Charles Nesson who led on the case. And he almost turned it into a school project for his students. He had a whole team of law students working on this because, yeah, he and the lawyers representing Jamie Thomas felt that there were some important questions about copyright law, but some other legal questions as well to be addressed in these lawsuits. And therefore, it was important that they went before courts and judges.
Now, Thomas, her defence was a bit different. As we said, she denied that she'd shared any files. And her initial argument was that a third party might have hacked or spoofed her internet connection.
So this was a Wi-Fi point.
Yeah.
The fact that the idea that early days of Wi-Fi possibly didn't have a password. Someone else must have logged in onto my Wi-Fi. And it didn't happen so much in the US cases, but I know, I think particularly in Germany, where there was a number of cases like this, whole debate then ensued around what is the responsibility of the owner of a Wi-Fi hub? Are we suggesting that in order to avoid liability of copyright infringement, you've got to have a password on your Wi-Fi hub? And if you don't have a password on your Wi-Fi hub, then you could be liable for anybody's infringement. But then what about cafes and restaurants and hotels that offer Wi-Fi as a service? And I say, it didn't really come up in the American cases the same. And even in the German cases, it did come up. But we never really got a proper resolution on that. But that was what Thomas was initially saying was, I don't know anything about this. Some unnamed third party must have hacked in to my internet connection. Although subsequently it was conceded that although she stood her ground that she hadn't downloaded any files, that maybe it was somebody she knew.
Or somebody in her house.
Somebody
one of her children,
in
possibly.
Her house had actually done the downloading.
But anyway, on that initial defence that someone must have been standing outside her house with a laptop downloading music, the jury didn't buy it and ordered her to pay $222,000 in damages.
So yes, at first instance, both Tenenbaum and Thomas lost. So the courts decreed that they were liable for infringement. As we've said, in Tenenbaum's case, he already admitted that. It was a damages issue. In Thomas's case, they didn't buy that some mysterious other person had done the infringing, so they held her liable for the copyright infringement. So at first instance, they both lost. As you've already said, because, and in both cases by this point, they had free legal representation, it was easier for them to appeal. So they did both appeal. And in both cases, although what subsequently happened went down slightly different routes, in both cases, we had a number of chapters still to come, as the judgments and the amount of damages that need to be paid got thought about and reconsidered at different levels in different courts for quite some time afterwards.
Yeah, so in Thomas's case, the judge ordered a retrial on the grounds that it was possible that the jury may have been incorrectly briefed in the first trial. So went through it all again. This is where slightly more compelling evidence that the infringement had happened within her house was presented by the label's side. And so she argued then that perhaps maybe, all right, maybe it did happen within the walls of my house, but it must have been one of my children or my then boyfriend who'd done it. I knew nothing about it. And it was, you know, they pointed out that she owned a lot of the tracks that she was accused of downloading on CD already. The tracks were shared in MP3 format. And although she had ripped some tracks to her computer, they were in WMA format.
Yeah, because she'd used, because in those days, a lot of Windows users would just put their CDs in, open up the Windows Media Player, whatever it was called, which would automatically rip them in a Microsoft format. But very few people on those file sharing networks back in the 2000s were interested in WMA files. Anyone who knew what they were doing with file sharing was making sure that they rip tracks or they acquire tracks as MP3, and that is how they shared them. So yeah, they were basically saying, okay, your evidence might suggest that this thing that was talked about in the first hearing, that some mysterious third party had hacked in, maybe we can't make that stand up. But what they were basically saying is, Jamie Thomas is not technically savvy enough to be doing the file sharing you're accusing her of. And I think there was then a little bit of a debate of, are we suggesting that you should now have to sue one of the kids, work out which of the children did it? But that was the slightly different arguments that were being presented by each side on take two of the Jamie Thomas case.
So hopeful that she could win second time round. That hope was fairly short-lived because she was not successful. And in fact, the second time round, she was found guilty of willful copyright infringement with damages set at $1.92 million. Which was a way off the $3.6 million top level.
But considerably more than what had been awarded in the first go.
Yes. So then her legal team filed another appeal, a motion, saying that such high damages were unconstitutional.
Yeah, and I suppose in the latter part of these lawsuits, both of them, the debate became much less about whether or not files have been shared and whether or not that constituted copyright infringement and so on and so forth, and much more about what were reasonable damages to be awarding the copyright owners, the record companies, when we had individuals, and in both cases, individuals of limited means, as the defendants. And at first instance, because these were copyright cases, and in America, copyright cases often go before juries, which wouldn't happen over here in the UK. And it's always interesting that juries always seem prone, when presented with this massive scale of statutory damages, to err towards a higher figure.
Yeah.
Or maybe somewhere in the middle. And quite often in copyright cases, as I say, where it's an individual involved, a judge might subsequently say, that seems a little bit over the top, and try, assuming the judge feels they have the power to do this on appeal, to bring the damages down. But in this case, yeah, as you say, the lawyers were arguing that this wasn't just wanting a nice judge to recognise that maybe the damages being awarded were a bit OTT. They were saying that actually there's a case under the American Constitution for saying where individuals involved in these cases, the damages that have been awarded are just insane.
Yeah, so 6 months after that second ruling in the Thomas case, another judge reduced the damages down to $54,000, saying that the nearly $2 million settlement set by the jury was monstrous and shocking.
I'm not sure it's monstrous, but it is quite shocking.
It's quite shocking. The RIAA then offered to do a deal with Thomas around that figure, saying it would accept a final settlement of $25,000. Seems reasonable. But then Thomas and her legal reps, perhaps feeling they were on a bit of a roll, refused that deal. So the RIAA appealed. A jury was consulted again.
Never a good idea.
Never a good idea, because they set the damages back up again to $1.5 million.
Despite, let's not forget, the previous statement that, okay, that was less than the $1.92 million, but I think monstrous and shocking would still apply to the $1.5 million as far as the judge had been concerned.
Yes, and indeed, a judge then reduced them back down to $54,000. But the RIAA appealed again and won again. And then a panel of three judges ruled that the original $222,000 damages was the most appropriate figure that she should be asked to pay. And therefore, that was what she was finally ordered to pay.
Even though the defendant in this case was a single mother of limited means, and that is still a phenomenal sum of money. And I suppose it's interesting, this whole debate about what are appropriate damages. And I guess, to an extent, what people were saying and some of the lawyers were arguing is, OK, there is a significant margin in the law with statutory damages. And yes, it's for the jury or in some cases a judge to decide what the figure should be, but maybe one of the criteria is this a billion-dollar company accused of copyright infringement or an individual?
Yeah.
And maybe that discretion that the law gives the jury, the judge, the court, over where you set them, maybe the means of the person who has been accused of infringement and found liable for infringement should be taken into consideration before you pick a figure.
Yeah, so Thomas attempted to appeal that ruling again, but that was rejected, so it was the final damages figure. The RIAA attempted again to do a deal with her. Part of that deal it offered was for her to pay a lower amount if she would be willing to make a warning video in which basically she got up and said, don't be an evil file sharer like me, or you'll have to pay a load of money, which, still maintaining that she never had shared any music online, refused.
By this point, her damages had gone up, down so many times. I think most people have lost track of what it was that she was meant to be paying. Meanwhile, over in the Tenenbaum case.
That was, yes, ongoing. Because although, yeah, 2013 was when her case ended. Tenenbaum's case, despite starting earlier, ended later. But going back to the aftermath of his original ruling, where he was ordered to pay $675,000, his damages were also reduced after they were deemed unconstitutional by the judge overseeing that case and were dropped to $67,500. Both sides then appealed that, then presented different other cases arguing precedence for the amount of damages that should be considered. The appeals court sided with the RIAA, mainly on procedural grounds, basically saying that the judge who reduced the damages hadn't done so correctly. He should have gone through a process called remittiteur, which would have given the labels the chance to accept or decline. And if they declined, that would force a new trial, which is what happened in the Thomas case. But that judge had immediately slashed the damages, which was not the correct procedure. So we went back again through the appeals process after that.
And if that's all rather confusing to follow, that's because this is all quite confusing to follow. There was more constitutional arguments as the entire thing continued to drag its way through the courts, with Tenenbaum's attorney, the aforementioned Nissen, continuing to say that the damages being set in this case were unconstitutional. He wanted an en banc hearing, which is basically what happens in the appeals court, where there are important legal issues at the heart of the case and more judges take part in the hearing rather than the usual panel of three.
He argued that the original trial was unconstitutional and therefore the judgment should be set aside because the judge should never have instructed the jury that they could award damages up to $4.5 million.
Which is the statutory damages, the 150 grand multiplied by the number of tracks that have been named in that lawsuit.
Especially as the judge then admitted that those damages were unconstitutional and dropped them. But the appeals court refused to take that case. Nissen took it to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court also refused to take it. And there were then two more attempts to have the decision overturned in lower courts, both of which failed. As a result, Tenenbaum also ended up with this massive damages bill to pay.
Yeah, by this point, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the music industry had moved on. We were no longer talking about suing individual fans, individual file sharers. The iTunes boom had happened. The streaming boom was about to begin. Nobody cared anymore, really, about all of this, apart from poor Thomas and Tenenbaum, who were left with these massive damages to pay. I say massive in the context of an individual, not in the case of a billion-dollar organisation. but certainly for individuals. And Tenenbaum ultimately declared himself bankrupt.
Yes, that happened in 2015 after he had exhausted all routes of appeal.
And boy, had he gone, more to the point, Nessen had, every possible route of appeal had been tested.
I mean, this is 12 years after he'd received that initial letter.
And long after anyone had been using Khazar.
It outlasted Khazar as well as the policy of suing individuals. But yeah, he declared himself bankrupt. He got the damages included in that bankruptcy so that he wouldn't have to pay them. And so the record labels never received any damages from him. So actually, ironically, it would have been better to accept that initial $500 that he'd offered.
Yeah, Thomas likewise was pretty much unable to pay those damages. And I suppose the key point about both of these cases is it proved, first of all, that going after individual file sharers with the stern letters demanding damages and ultimately, when people call their bluff, going to court, yes, the law is on your side. Yes, we have now pretty clear precedent that if people are sharing music online without license, that is copyright infringement. Sue them. And even where the person says, somebody else used my Wi-Fi network, there's still grounds for holding them liable. And there are significant damages, even if not quite as significant as some juries would like. But nevertheless, significant damages available to copyright owners. The law is on the record industry's side. But in the end, they didn't make any money out of this.
No.
Bearing in mind just how much they would have spent on lawyers and other costs taking it through all of these tediously long appeal processes. So no money was made out of all of this. Okay, yes, they won the legal argument. Okay, yes, maybe along the way they set some useful precedents for future cases. But the PR side of this, and we've alluded to this on past editions of Setlist when we've looked at the music industry's early attempts to deal with online piracy throughout the 2000s, throughout all of this, much of the narrative in the media, because these stories, particularly in the early days with those big initial damages sums, made their way into mainstream media, and repeatedly it was portrayed as the big corporate Sony, Universal, Warner, the mega super rich. I mean, okay, not as super rich as they had been 15 years earlier.
It was still a period where the labels and their artists were generally portrayed as being greedy and money grabbing.
And, you know, some of the artists were famously millionaire artists taking on this student and single mother, David versus Goliath.
Yes, taking on their fans. And you mentioned right back at the beginning that the labels do not like, or us, or just people generally, referring to it as sue the fans. If it was at the time, if it was ever referred to as that, label execs would always say, well, these people aren't music fans.
Yeah, they can't possibly
be fans. If they were music fans, they'd pay for it. It's like, yeah. Well, they're downloading lots of music to listen to because they like music.
And particularly with sort of younger people who are downloading. So Tenenbaum was 20 when this happened. And if we assume it was actually Jamie Thomas's kids who were doing the file sharing, there was that whole thing where those people would often say, but I pay to go to these artists' gigs and I buy their merchandise. Now, sometimes actually that wasn't true. And,
yeah.
That was this case. And of course, from a music industry perspective, it's like, but you don't understand. The record companies spend a lot of money getting these artists out there, making these recordings so that you now know these artists exist. Yes, you may be spending money on tickets, you may be spending on merch, but the labels don't see any of that benefit. So that doesn't add up. But I think suing the fans was never a good idea.
No.
And I say, you know, fair enough to the UK record industry. They tried it, hoping it might be a deterrent, quickly realised it wasn't a deterrent, gave up on it, and then went on to the next thing on the list. Whereas I think a lot of people, I know for definite a couple of the people who were quite high up in the RIAA at the time, with hindsight, have conceded, this didn't achieve anything. And if anything, even though they won, it was counterproductive and it just damaged the reputation. And it also played into the narrative of this is another reason why you should be stealing the music. Because look at these terrible corporates grabbing money off this student and this single mother. Screw them. Let's steal all their music because they don't deserve to be getting paid. Even though that argument wasn't credible, but it played into the narrative of the evil record industry, which did not help the record industry.
But still, even after ditching the policy, the RIAA did defend it.
Officially,
saying that despite the fact that it had not necessarily been financially successful, it was successful in increasing awareness that file sharing was illegal. They were saying that kind of initially there was like a 30% awareness that it was illegal. And then they did this letter writing campaign and suing campaign, and it went up to more than 70%. In 2011, the RA's PR rep, Liz Kennedy, went so far as to claim that the lawsuits were the reason for the growth of the legitimate digital music market by bringing illegal activity under control, which is quite a bold claim to make.
And almost certainly not true.
Absolutely not true.
And obviously, really, although some of the subsequent things that the Record Industry tried, once they'd given up on Sue the Fans, just like they'd given up on Sue the Technology Providers, just like they'd given up on DRM, they recognised all of that didn't work. It just took some people longer to recognise it than was ideal. And then they pursued the other things that we have also talked about on past setlist specials. So go and look for them in the archive. They tried free strikes or graduated response, which in some ways was another version of this Sue the Fans, but preferably without having to actually do any suing. And then they pushed into web blocking, which of all of the things they've tried, I mean, there are all sorts of issues with web blocking, but I mean, I think it's probably the least counterproductive anti-piracy thing. I think there probably are merits to the web blocking approach, which is what here in the UK has to an extent become the primary anti-online piracy tactic employed by the record industry. Unfortunately, US copyright law as yet doesn't allow web blocking. But I mean, ultimately, what overcame online piracy in music, and I think there's lots of mainly anecdotal but also some sort of more substantial research that's kind of proving this, because we're sort of getting into an era now where online piracy, particularly download-based piracy, remains a much bigger problem for the movie and TV industry than it does for the music industry, which kind of proves the point that I'm not saying that you shouldn't be doing any of these litigation routes, particularly if there's law that needs to be tested. And as I say, I think web blocking to an extent is quite a good idea. But most importantly of all, to combat online piracy, you need to make sure that the legitimate services are 10 times better than the illegal services.
Yes.
And as we sort of alluded to earlier, in the early days of downloads, actually the opposite was happening. Because of the anti-piracy stuff, the legal services were not as compelling as the illegal services. That started to switch, and I think once we've shifted over to streaming for definite, particularly while there were free streaming services, when you talk to teenagers today about accessing music through illegal downloads, a lot of them will say, well, why would I go to the effort of illegally downloading music, which is a pain, partly because of things like web blocking, but also just because it's a bit of a clunky experience and always was, versus installing the Spotify app on my phone and getting music for free. Contrasting that with TV and movies, where you can be a Netflix subscriber, an Amazon Prime subscriber, a Now TV subscriber, and have YouTube and the BBC iPlayer installed on your device, and still there's plenty of films and TV shows which you can't legally access through any of those services. Yeah. So then going to a Pirate Bay or wherever is more attractive. So yeah, she's wrong. Okay, some of the anti-piracy stuff probably was worth pursuing even with hindsight, but the most important thing was making more compelling legal services and not being seen as the Goliath in a David versus Goliath lawsuit, as is what happened with both the Tenenbaum and Thomas case.
But that brings to an end another of our special editions in this top 10 legal battles series.
Yeah, it's true that although I think the record industry were fools to pursue this litigation and it wasn't productive in combating online piracy, for us, it was entertaining to watch.
Yes.
And that's always good.
And we got a podcast episode out of it.
So well done to the RIAA for pursuing legal action against pesky Joel Tenenbaum and Jamie Thomas.
As ever, any questions or comments, direct those to setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Maltz, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Beattie, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.